This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you Saturday afternoons here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Each week, you listen in as I visit with a World War II veteran and hear some stories about that time in our history, very personal stories, very unique perspectives on history. This is really being an eyewitness to history, and that's what this show is all about, preserving those stories, honoring our veterans for their service, the sacrifices that they've made, and maybe along the way inspiring some of us of younger generations to live up to that legacy that the greatest generation has given us. It was a great pleasure to meet so many of you last week at our Lifestyle Expo, and again, all the material from the seminars there is online at kmjnow.com if you go to the Paul Leffler page, and I invite you to go there today. You'll see some pictures of my guest today and the very unique souvenir that he brought back from the notorious Nordhausen death camp in Germany during World War II. But before we get to our guest today, I need to tell you about a few events. And first of all, a disclaimer, next week we will not have a program. Hometown Heroes will not air next Saturday because of Bulldog football. That'll be happening a few times throughout football season. And the first one is next Saturday as Fresno State is at Wisconsin. So you won't hear Hometown Heroes next week. It'll return the week following. And if you're looking for something to do next Saturday afternoon, I've got a great idea for you. If you were at our seminar last week at the Lifestyle Expo, you heard about a project called Veterans Voices, an all-volunteer project that matches veterans with people who want to hear their stories. The program is free of charge. It requires just about an hour of your time. All the interviews are done by trained adult and youth volunteers. If you're a veteran and you tell your story, your interview will be transferred to DVD, submitted to the Veterans History Project, the Library of Congress, and one copy will be sent to share with you and your family. And they are doing interviews for veterans of all ages and all wartime experiences. Those interviews will take place at the Fresno VA Medical Center next Saturday, September 12th. So if you're interested in going there for about an hour and talking about your experiences in the military, call this number, 559-445-0015. Be part of the Veterans Voices Project, a great project by some great people who I've known for a long time. Also, speaking of great people, I had the great pleasure of speaking to the Central Valley Blue Star Moms a little more than a week ago, and from now through November, they're doing their package donation drive for troops currently overseas. So if you want to know what the troops need, what the Blue Star Moms are going to put together for them, and find out what you can do to help, go to cvbluestarmoms.org, and I'll have that link on our website, kmjnow.com, as well. And just one more note, from time to time you hear some great military music on this program, and speaking of great military music, the Sounds of Freedom Military Band and the Association of the United States Army are bringing the President's Own, the United States Marine Band, to Fresno. They'll be at the Soroyan Theater on October 20th at 7:30, and you can get as many as 4 free tickets. So to find out how to do that, go to our website, kmjnow.com. All the instructions will be there for you under the Paul Leffler page. Okay, so we have that business taken care of, and now let's get on to the business of the program, what we do every week, visiting with World War II veterans. And this week, no different. Joe Rivas is my guest. He's 87 years old, and he has a very interesting story, a very intriguing story. He's going to tell us about the souvenir that he still has from his time in World War II. But we'll start early on. The question that I like to start with everybody, Joe, is about December 7th, 1941. Where were you, and what do you remember about that day and how you found out about the attack on Pearl Harbor and the fact that, like it or not, America was now a part of World War II?
Yes, I was here in Fresno, and I went to church, and we were walking. We knew about it already in the news, and that's about it, you know. But I remember the day real well, and that's about it.
Did you realize at the time that this was probably going to impact your life, that you were going to be old enough to serve in the military and that Uncle Sam might be calling you?
Yes, I already knew that. I was already working for, I worked in a shipyard before that, and I knew that since 1939 we knew we was in trouble. So I knew more or less what was up, what was going. But we didn't expect that to happen here at Pearl Harbor.
Well, I don't know if anyone expected it the way it happened, but no one that I've talked to yet has forgotten about that day and what it meant to them. So at that time, you were 19, almost 20 years old. How long was it until you were wearing a uniform?
3 years later, I was, I think, 23 years old now. I got drafted. But I was working in a, I didn't have to go because I was working for a foundry where they were making parts for the Mare Island PT boats and all that. And I was deferred, really. So I was the only single guy there. And the boss used to be kind of push guys around. He only tried it with me one time, and that was it. I got into it with him. So I quit.
So you were ready to go into the service by that point?
Well, I was ready in a way, but like I said, I didn't volunteer. I was working. I had a pretty good job. I did then. I don't know. So they did send me to school to learn how to Morse code and all that. But then I was in upper class, and when they didn't want to, like I told you a while ago, I was detailed the day they had the test, and they wouldn't let me take it. So I just told them to shove it, and then they transferred me to a gun battalion.
Funny how that works. So you were taking the test to progress as a radio man and maybe do that line of work, but because you missed that one test when they had you somewhere else, you ended up on a gun crew, right?
Yes, that was it. We learned a little of everything right there in Camp Calvin. We really didn't take a training in the 90 millimeters till we went, till they transferred us to Fort Bliss, Texas. That's where I learned all about the 90 millimeter anti-aircraft gun.
And by this time, like you said, the war's been going on for a while. So I'm sure even while you were working in the foundry, you were following the headlines, you knew how the war was going, what was going on. Did you care where they sent you? Were you kind of itching to get over and get some action? Or what was your mindset?
Well, I just didn't want to go to South Pacific. I don't know why. I'm glad that I got sent to Europe. And from Fort Bliss, Texas, they sent me to Maryland. And then we got our clothes there. And I was in Boston Harbor the day of the invasion in France. So I was already in the ship.
So on June 6, 1944, the day that Operation Overlord was starting and the troops were landing on the beaches of Normandy, you were leaving the beaches of the United States and heading across on the USS Wakefield, I believe, right?
Yes, sir, yes. It took us 8 days to get to Liverpool, England. And we zigzagged all the way up till we got there because we were not escorted. We went by ourselves. The USS Wakefield is a ship as big as the Queen Mary. So that's about it.
Now, what was that like for you? Is it safe to assume that you had spent pretty much all of your life in and around California, and now this was a pretty big adventure for you, right?
Yes, I was in California. I had never been out of California, just here, and that's about it. I did field work. I did a little of everything. So I know what field work is, and I know what the warehouse is, and I know what the foundry work is.
So as you're heading over there, like you said, it took 8 days. You're zigzagging to avoid any German U-boats that might still be hanging out in the Atlantic anywhere. And you've got tons of guys on the ship around you. What was the mood like? Did you get the sense that everyone was kind of anxious about it? Were you thinking they can take as long as they want to get there, or we're in no hurry to see any combat? Or were you kind of itching to get over there and get in the middle of it?
Well, it did. To tell you the truth, we didn't care really. We knew we had to do what we had to do, but while I was in the ship, we could hear the news, and they had reported us sunk. We was in the ship, but the New York news had said that the Germans had sunk the ship. Where we was in, and it wasn't true.
So you're on the Wakefield, and you hear a report, the Wakefield has sunk.
Yes, the Germans had said that they had sunk it, but they didn't. So next thing you know, we was in England. So
that was your first taste of the propaganda machine that they had over there. So then you got to England, and still not seeing a whole lot of combat yet, just training for what you might see a little later down the road?
Well, in England, it's more like replacement. We'd be in one place maybe 4 or 5 weeks and then move again and just move again, take different trainings. And mostly infantry training and showing us what goes. Saw a lot of movies, and a lot of paratroopers. Airborne was there taking. I got to go to big place in England, where the Queen is.
Buckingham Palace?
Yes, we went on a leave. You get in a little troop train, and just a little train, and just take it. It takes about a day to get there. And then we just tour around there, and it had been bombed quite a bit. It looked pretty bad. Then we came home, came back, and continued with our training. That was it. So I left, maybe 4 months later to go to France.
Now, during this time, I just want to give the listeners an idea of what this is like for you. And you're 22 years old. Like you said, you've never been out of California before. Now you're halfway across the world. Are you having any contact at all with your family back home? You had a brother who was in the service also. Are you communicating with anybody at all?
Yes, I used to write home a lot because it didn't cost us nothing. We just put free instead of a stamp and write home, you know. They knew where we was at. But we weren't allowed to say where we was at the combat mission or where we was at because our letters were censored. But the advantage I had, I could write Spanish. I used to write them in Spanish and then put free on it. I don't think very many people could understand it.
So the censors weren't paying attention to the Spanish. You might be able to slip a thing or two in there, huh?
Well, not really, but I could talk to my mother, telling her that I was fine, you know. But we couldn't give the location where we was at. They knew it was in England, but somewhere in England, that's all.
Now, you just brought up being able to write in Spanish. And I'm curious, among the guys that you were with, in your unit and everybody around you, were there a decent amount of Hispanic troops? Did they have some of you working together? Was there anyone else that spoke Spanish around there? Or how unique did you feel in being a Hispanic soldier?
No, we didn't look at it that way. We looked like ourselves like we were Americans, you know. Mm-hmm. We didn't say that because we were born here and raised here. And they didn't ask the Germans if they were German Americans or not that. Mm-hmm. And so...
And you felt the guys that you served with didn't treat you any different.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, they treated me just like one of them, and that was it.
As it should be. I'll tell you what, we're about that point where we need to take our first commercial break. He mentioned leaving for France. So when we come back, we're going to talk about that. When he landed on Omaha Beach, what that scene was like, and what would happen once he would encounter combat, and the amazing discovery that his unit made in 1945, April of 45 to be precise. You're listening to Hometown Heroes. Joe Rivas is our guest today. We'll be right back here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, here with you on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Remember, if you have a veteran in your life that you think I ought to catch up with, email me, paul@kmjnow.com. A reminder again, next week we will not have a program. Bulldog football at Wisconsin will bump us off for a week. But it's a pleasure to share today's program with Joe Rivas, 87 years old of Fresno. He spent the most interesting time of his World War II service in Europe. And when we left off, he was heading from England to France. Now, you landed on Omaha Beach, which, of course, on the day you left America, June 6th, was pretty intense. By the time you got there, I guess you got a taste of the aftermath of that Normandy invasion. What do you remember seeing as you approached that beach and got ready to exit the landing craft?
Well, what I saw that the French hadn't done any cleanup on it. Everything was still dirty. Some bodies were still floating. Those crossbars were there. And then when we got on top, we had our duffel bags and all our belongings with us. We got on top, and there was fox soldiers that had dead Germans in there, and they just had some paper on to tell us not to handle anything because they could be booby-trapped. So we ended up, that was about 20 or 30 miles from the beach in St. Lô, mm-hmm. France. In French, St. Lô, that's where they boarded us on the troop train, or one of their trains, which they call 40 or 8. Mm-hmm. 40 men or 8 mules is what they said it was. So we boarded them.
Now, did they put more than 40 of you in there?
No, they were pretty, it was about 40 of us in there. And there was maybe five or six cars with 40 beds on them. I remember that real well. And they took off, and they were small cars. They weren't very big. And I remember the we went down and just go right to France, and everywhere we would stop, here comes the Frenchman trying to sell us apple juice or something so we could drink. And that was about it. And when we got to Paris, I got to get off because for some reason I was more or less in charge of the car. They gave it to me. And I went out and got some bread. And I remember bringing a bunch of bread, a lot of it, just like bringing wood in.
You had your arms full of loaves of bread, like a basket of firewood, huh?
Yeah, it was French bread. So I bought it. Here you are, guys. So that was it. And that was in Paris. The next thing I knew, we took off again, and we ended up in Verviers, Belgium. That's where we ended up our train trip. I was in Verviers for maybe 4 days, and put us in a hat factory. That's where we was at. We didn't take no training anymore. Our training was over.
And by this time, you had trained on just about everything, from your rifle, obviously, an M1 that you'd have with you, to these bigger guns, a 90mm or the Quad 50 with 450 caliber guns on it. And I understand that as far as developing your aim, and should you ever get in a situation to fire those guns, that you had a little help from nature in terms of practicing. Tell our listeners what you did to try to test your aim and your ability to follow things flying through the air.
I didn't take training in the Quad 50s, but I tried it out, you know, because it was out on the beach, and they let us get on, and it was all remote control. It was very nice where you sit in the little seat. You want to go up, you just guide it up, or you turn it with your hands, and it turns. You could follow. We could trace seagulls. You could put that target right on, and you could follow just like following a plane, and it was fun.
And before PETA gives us a call, you weren't shooting at the seagulls. You were just following them through the sight. I want to get that one straight. No ammo in the gun. But before long, you'd be in a situation where not only would you think about shooting, but maybe some other people were shooting at you. And I imagine, knowing that you're part of a replacement group, that when they call you replacement, at some point you're going to have to replace somebody. And the reason you're replacing them is because their numbers have dwindled, because guys have been taken out. There are casualties. Were you kind of anxiously awaiting that moment? Did you go to bed every night wondering when it was going to be that you guys would be called to closer to the front lines?
Well, when we ended in Germany, it didn't take long for me to get appointed to an outfit. So of all the training I got put into a tank destroyer outfit. And that was towed at a half track, and they had a 76mm gun. They put me on without even training on a tank destroyer outfit. I was the number one man. I'm the one that used to cross the beach and fire the gun. We was in the Roar Valley, and we would fire across into about 5 miles, 6 miles. Mm-hmm. And that was it. I mean, it was something that just came natural for me. Then the infantry finally came up later on, and that's when the 104th Infantry Division came over. And the infantry guys were telling us how easy we had it because we didn't have to walk up in the front lines. So I volunteered to go with them.
What were you thinking? Didn't somebody tell you you're never supposed to volunteer for anything in the Army?
Oh, yes, they told me, but I just couldn't stand them telling me that we had it made, that we were we didn't have to go up the front line. Because actually, the river was almost 5 miles from where we was at. And when we fired that gun, we were getting our orders from Corps Artillery. So they would tell us range and azimuth and elevation. I'm the one to set the range elevation. And then when we would get on target, they would say on target. Then they'd say fire at will, and we just let them go as many as we want, as many rounds. And then Corps Artillery would say cease firing, and they would tell us mission accomplished. And they would tell us what we did.
And what was that like when you heard how the degree to which your efforts had been successful, whether you took out a certain position that they had or the ammo that you fired did some damage? Did that mean anything to you? Did it matter to you one way or the other whether you were successful with that?
Not really. We were just there, like, doing a job. But we weren't, I really don't remember being scared of anything. Like I say, I volunteered to go. When the infantry, I volunteered to go with them. And then the first ones that chickened out, they wanted to come back. I said, well, hey, you guys asked me to come over here, so let's keep going. But when I got back with my outfits, I was all right. The only thing that we missed over there was hot chow. We had K rations, and when we was up in the front lines, and that was about it. But we had never we did go hungry. A lot of sugar beets there, and in fact, there was a cow coming by there. I stopped that cow and milked and got some milk from the cow. We do things like that, you know. Just
that's where growing up in Central California comes in handy, huh? Knowing how to milk a cow.
Yeah, we know how to survive, you know. But I was never hungry or nothing like that. We had good. The rations that they gave us was good enough to keep us going.
Now I've got to ask you, because of where you were and the time that you were there, that was the harshest winter that area of the world in recorded history had ever seen. And of course, everybody knows about the Battle of the Bulge in late 1944 and carrying on into early 1945. Where were you at that time, and did you ever have a hard time stopping from shivering at night when you were trying to sleep?
It was cold. We were not too far from Ischwiller and Wischwiller, or Dusseldorf. We were not too far from there. But when they took it for the training, we went back to Aachen, Germany. And the only thing that was, the food wasn't, we didn't get hot meals or anything, but we survived, you know.
You told me that you were never scared. So far, it sounds like a cakewalk. You always had everything you needed. You were always plenty warm. You were never scared. Are you telling me the truth here? I'm sure there had to be a time or two where you came pretty close, or you saw some fire coming in, or you realized, boy, that was a close call.
No, I was scared. We were scared, but we learned to live with it. It wasn't that being scared. If we were scared, I got strafed. And when I woke up in the morning, the wall where I was at, the bullets were right next to me. But the German planes in that fire 50 caliber, they had 31 caliber. And there, the brick building where I was at, the wall, they're around them. Pennant going to the where it was at.
So it couldn't get through the brick wall. Good thing.
Their planes didn't have what we had, what ours did.
But I can't imagine that that's very encouraging when you wake up in the morning and you look right next to you and there's bullet holes everywhere.
I knew they were there because I could feel it. I was shaking, you know, I could feel it.
And that didn't bother you at all? Didn't make you think?
Yeah, it bothered us because, what's going to happen next? All I can remember is all our trucks and what's it called, the guns, their tires were all flat, their windshields were all broken with the airplanes strafing them, you know, strafing the street where they was at. So they did more damage to our equipment than they did to the soldiers. We would always find the house with a basement and we'd go down in the basement and sleep down in the basement.
Whatever it takes to get to one more day, you did it, and you're living proof because you're here sitting with me right now. We need to take another break. When we come back, we're going to get closer and closer to the, really, I think, one of the more intriguing aspects of Joe's story, a discovery that he and some fellow soldiers made in April of 1945. It's going to be very descriptive and maybe even hard to believe, but you're going to hear it straight ahead. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest this week is Joe Rivas, 87 years old. He lives in Fresno, but about 65 years ago, he was in Europe. He was in Germany. You heard him tell about what he did while the Battle of the Bulge was raging on. Of course, from there, as he hooked up with the 104th Infantry Division, more specifically the 414th Infantry Regiment, he was on foot quite a bit, heading toward the Rhine River. He would reach there by the spring of 1945. Now, Joe, you've told me that you volunteered for a lot of stuff in the Army, which you're not supposed to do. That's how you get yourself in trouble. But you volunteered, and you ended up with that infantry regiment as a scout, which means you're out in front of most of the troops?
Yes, I'm the one that I was in point. I was first, me and my partner were the first. In fact, we were first to reach the Rhine River.
Now, Now, what when you're out in front of everybody else like that, was that kind of an alone feeling, or do you kind of like the fact that you can control things because you don't have too many other people to worry about?
No, they were right behind us. We led, but they were behind us. It was maybe 50 yards behind us, some farther and some closer. But we were the first ones out there. So we had backing, so we weren't really worried about that.
Now, you know, and a lot of times during war, you don't know the big picture. You don't know what the generals are thinking and where they want you to go and why. But I'm sure you knew that the Rhine River was an important barrier to cross or important place to reach. And in fact, the way I understand it, there was actually kind of a race going on between your unit and some other units.
Yes, we were 104th and the 2nd Division were seeing who would get to the Rhine first, and we beat them. So 2nd Division, which was pretty popular because they went all over Korea and everything. So, but we were there first.
Now, it wasn't just like a foot race or a car race or a bicycle race. There's some opposition along the way. Did you sense that there was an excitement or an adrenaline in the air as you got closer and closer to that river, and were you maybe more on guard of what you might face?
Not really. We knew that Cologne was pretty well taken care of by the Air Force. They had really bombed it up. So we didn't expect opposition. The only thing we were seeing was buzz bombs coming from the other side of the river where they'd fly over us. And when we got to the Rhine River, we could see them and they could see us, but they were more or less like a truce. Nobody was firing at each other. They weren't firing at us anymore, or we weren't firing at them. We could see them, they could see us across the river.
Did that give you a sense of pride to know that you were the first ones to get to the Rhine?
I didn't think about it at the time. It just, things that happened. That was my mission, I think, because I was a scout. That doesn't mean that I was the first man there, because you take night patrols and all that go out. They go scout all over that, but that's not official. I was there officially as a point. But night patrols and all that thing, they did that. They used to go patrol over there, but they weren't supposed to be seen or heard of or nothing. That was part of it. We were just officially the first ones there.
And later on, you'd be officially the first one somewhere else, or at least pretty close to the first ones. As you got closer to April, and there would be more combat to come, but you came upon an area of Germany, Nordhausen. And that was a day that you remember, not just because of what happened there in Germany and what you saw, but because of something that happened back here in the States. What was it about that day that made it so unique and so memorable?
Well, as we was going into the cave, it was covered with netting and everything, camouflage. As we was going there, the lieutenant that took us there, she says, "I got some bad news for you." She says, "What is it?" I said, "We just lost our commander-in-chief." So that meant that Roosevelt died that day. That he had just died as we were going to enter the cave.
And now this cave is not a bear cave. It's not a bat cave. It's not your ordinary cave. This is miles and miles of tunnels, 50 feet high tunnels, that were hidden from view, is where they constructed the V-1 and the V-2 rocket bombs that were, of course, top secret and very unique to Germany at that time. And the people building those bombs were slave laborers. They had more than 20,000 prisoners, mostly Polish and French, from what I understand, who had been slaving away there. And you stumbled not just upon those tunnels, but that concentration camp. What kinds of things did you see, and how hard was it to stomach?
Well, it's like you take a shipyard, it's out in the open, you could see rows and rows. That's what I saw. And then further down in the cave, it was a basement, real low. And that's where they had all the people down there. They treated them like animals because they fed them like try a hash out of a big barrel and that was that. And that was civilians, young women and men, and that was all mixed in there. And they were glad that we were there, really.
How many survivors did you come across, or were there more corpses than living people?
Well, I really couldn't tell you because there were so many of them. We were different places. We weren't there that long, and we didn't write no notes on them. Our duty was to patrol it, and then we'd go back to our, and then have somebody else relieve us back and forth. So we would take turns going in there, just patrolling. But there was nothing to do there. We weren't doing nothing. We just more or less stayed there. And the only ones that were there that didn't want to talk to us was the SS or the nurses, because they were SS. They belonged to the SS. They didn't want to have nothing to talk to us. They would shy away from us, or we want to talk to them.
Well, I don't blame them. They certainly didn't want to be found out for what they had done there. Now, you've seen all the, you saw it firsthand. You've seen the pictures of that camp and other camps. I'm curious, up to that point, did you have any idea that stuff like that existed, that people could be treated so horribly and tortured to that extent? Or was that a real shock to your system?
It was a shock to my system, more or less, because we didn't believe it until we got there and saw it. The way I describe it, they were just like you go to the vineyards and see how they lay the trays out with to dry the raisins. That's the way the bodies were, all next to each other, just rows and rows of them. And it stunk real bad. We had to walk around with a handkerchief over our nose because it smelled so bad, the odor of the dead people there. And there was all just, they claimed there was 13,000 of them, but later on, they said it was 5,000. Well, I really don't know. Our engineers went and dug a big trench, put them in there, burned them up, covered them up. Our engineers did that.
Well, and obviously it was a morbid job. It was a morbid scene. But in the midst of this, you came across something that caught your eye, and we'll talk about it a little more in a few minutes. But how soon was it, once you got in there, that you spied this big symbol of what the Nazi regime represented and their oppression of not just the Jews, but so much of Europe? Tell me how this particular item caught your eye.
Well, we was in their headquarters, and I spotted, you mean the flag? I spotted the flag. That's when we first got there. And so I went up to the attic and brought it down. It's the one that I brought down, which is 12 by 5.
And we're going to talk more about that after our last commercial break here in just a minute, and some more descriptions of what that item is. And a reminder, you can go to our website, kmjnow.com, and see some photos of it and see some photos of Joe holding it. And I'm curious also, when you guys left there, because you're with these other guys from the Timberwolves, the 104th Infantry Division, guys that you've been around for a while, after you left that place, is it something that you talked about, what you had seen there, or was it something that nobody wanted to talk about?
We didn't talk about it. We just regularly, it was part of the war, because we understood that wasn't the only concentration camp there. And to us, we had already gone to the worst. So we just kept going. From there on, we'd go to villages where there was nothing really, just especially the airports were the ones that were real bad. They were bombed out. And one thing the Germans they had what they call the Autobahn. There's a super highway. And we went to that, but it was bombed out by our bombers. But we zigzagged back and forth and got to go to further, towards the Elbe River, really, that's where we went.
And we're going to talk more about that and more of that very unique souvenir that Joe Rivas still has today when we come back. We'll catch our final commercial break and then come back with all the details, what that souvenir is, what's on it that makes it even more unique, and where it's destined for after all is said and done. You're listening to Hometown Heroes. This is News Talk 580 KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. What a pleasure it's been to visit with Joe Rivas today about his experiences during World War II. He's 87 years old, and he's got quite the souvenir. In fact, just a moment ago, I watched him sign his name on one of the souvenirs. You also have a German bayonet around here somewhere, right?
Yes. You want to see him?
I'll take a look at that. Maybe I'll put a picture of that on the website, too. Stay where you are, though. Let's talk about this some more while our listeners are tuning in to us here. The souvenir that we were talking about before the break is something I don't think you'll find very often anywhere. It's a 5-foot by almost 13-foot banner. It's red with a white circle in the middle, and in that circle, the black swastika, the trademark Nazi symbol. You pulled this out of a building in Nordhausen, Germany, site of the infamous Nordhausen death camp, a subcamp of Buchenwald, online at our website, kmjnow.com. I'll have some links you can read about it.
It was on top of the building when I went brought it down. It was on. It was.
The second you saw it, you thought, I've got to grab that and take it home?
As soon as I got there, I saw it. I'm going to bring that down.
Did you tell anybody that was what you were thinking?
No, I just went out there. When everybody was going in there, I just went after it. Since I was one of the first guys there, I just went after and brought it down.
And I'm sure you had to use a knife or something to cut it down, right?
Well, I had the rope. I just brought the rope. I don't remember how it's been so long. I don't remember what I did, but all I know is that I brought it down. And then we laid it out, and I had them guys sign those.
Now, in the middle, around the swastika and the white circle, are about 20 or more signatures. These were all guys in your company?
Yes. Yes, they were with me. They were the guys that were with me in my outfit.
Did you ever think that one of them might try to swipe it from you?
Not really. I just folded it up, and I kept it with me everywhere I go, wherever I went. And I won't tell everybody who was at half the time, but I kept it pretty well.
But all these years, you never put your name on it. Was there a reason why?
Not really, because I owned it. But now it's there now. I just signed it right now just to, but I've been thinking of doing that. I just didn't sign it because it belonged to me. I just wanted their addresses. And I wrote to some guys. Some of them guys communicated with me.
Yeah, and we don't know how many of them are still living, but on there are names and their hometowns. And you told me that recently you heard from one of the gentlemen whose name is on there?
Yes. My nephew, when they made the book, he sent letters to all of these guys that was in that flag. And one of them guys actually called me. Uh-huh. And he remembered me. He says I was a real crazy guy because I take all them chances. But I didn't look at it that way. I was just brought up that way, I guess.
And I would think that just going up to get that flag alone was taking a bit of a chance, because even though, in theory, the resistance is gone at this point and they've evacuated this camp, I imagine you're kind of making yourself a target if you go right to one of their prized symbols and start taking it down.
Well, the advantage I had was that where I went up was between there and the hill. So if there was any shooting going, they had to be on the other side of the building. So I really, I before I went there, I looked over, because I had to go up, and I went up in the attic, and then there was, from the attic I got in the window, and then I brought it down.
And that was almost 65 years ago. It'll be 65 years this upcoming April that happened. You've kept it all this time. You just signed your name on it just moments ago. When you look at it, what does it mean to you? Do you think about what it represented and what the Americans and the Allied troops saved the world from? Do you think about the horrors of that death camp? What does come to your mind when you look at it?
Not too much. I'm just proud that I was brave enough to bring it down and that I have it. That's about it. It's not. I don't consider myself a hero. I just consider myself doing something that had to be done.
Now, I hate to ask this question, but you are 87 years old. You're not going to be here forever. Have you thought about what you're going to do with this? Do you want to keep it in your family? Have you thought about giving it to a museum? What are your plans?
I was thinking of giving it to right here, but I have a granddaughter that collects things. She collects bayonets, swords, she's going to end up with it. It's going to be hers. She just turned 21 here a couple of days ago. And she collects these things, so she's going to end up with it, I'm pretty sure.
Well, you've taken pretty good care of it for more than 60 years, so I'm sure she will, too. It looks like it could have been taken down from the tower a couple of weeks ago. It's not even all that faded, and you can definitely tell what it is. Now, that was April of 45. A month later, the Germans had surrendered. Are you thinking, I'm going to get to go home, or are you thinking, great, now they're going to send me to Japan?
Well, I got pulled in at headquarters. And they told me that I did not have to come to Europe, I mean, to fight Japan. Mm-hmm. So since I had been overseas 13 months, my war was over as far as they were concerned. So they were, what was scheduled then was four infantry divisions from Europe were going to come to California or the West Coast and take amphibious training with the Marine Corps. So I asked him, where are we going to go? He says, San Luis Obispo. I'm going with him. I says, that's 3 hours from my home. Uh-huh. So I decided not to stay in Europe and just take my chances. So Japan can't equip the rest of us now. So I'm going with him. So I was home on the 30-day leave when the war ended.
What did that mean to you? How big of a relief was that for you, having seen everything that you saw, experienced all those close calls, knowing how horrible war could be, and now knowing it's over for you? What did that feel like for you?
Well, I didn't think too much about it because I just figured, well, now I can settle down and get a job and start working. And I know that we're the best, as far as I'm concerned. As far as Japan, I'm glad I didn't go to Japan. And I figured they had a pretty rough time over there, the ones that fought in the South Pacific. Because when we went in Europe, the people over there were nice. It was Hitler, it was SS troops that were bad. But the German people themselves were just like we were. They were just human beings, just like us.
Tell me about this. How many kids and grandkids do you have?
I just have one daughter. Uh-huh. One daughter and one granddaughter, that's all.
Well, the only reason I asked was obviously they wouldn't have been here if you didn't make it home from World War II, if you hadn't survived everything that you experienced. But also, when you talk to your granddaughter, who you said is a collector and is very interested in this and will own this banner when you're done with it, if she were to ask you, what was World War II all about? What were you guys doing over there, and why were you doing it? Do you know an answer to give her? What would you tell her if she asked you something like that?
Well, not really. I don't know what to say, but I remember when we got there, what they used to say over there. Hitler would say, first we'll get Europe, and then we'll conquer the world. That was their belief in Germany. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that we went over and wiped them out in Germany. But it wasn't the people. It was just the SS troops, like Hitler and some of their officers and all. But the people themselves, they were forced into it, just like some of us here were. But the American people, a lot of them volunteered. The American people were ready to fight.
And I'm sure that you had a lot of fun with the guys that you served with, and you've got lots of stories that you haven't told me and that we don't have time for you to tell me today. But did you get the sense that everybody serving with you was thinking the same thing you were, that you were all in it together?
Well, yes and no, because when I was in the ship, I met a couple of Mexican boys in the ship, and they asked me if I was going for thirds or first or second or thirds. I thought they meant chow. Uh-huh. I said, no, I already ate. I'm not hungry. So I said, no, we don't mean that. We mean fighting in combat. Uh-huh. Well, one of them had been there twice already, and the other one had been there once. So they invited me to go with them. As soon as we hit France, they were going to go abandon ship and go to Spain and desert. I said, no, forget it. And that's the last I saw of them.
Well, one last question for you. With all the time that you spent in the service, all the time during World War II, is there one thing that you're most proud of that when you reflect back on it, you feel really good about having done?
Not really. I didn't volunteer for it. I went because I was drafted. Yep. But I'm glad that I came home, and I'm glad that everything turned out to be the way it did. And I'm proud that we won the war.
Well, thank you very much for sharing those stories with us, and thank you for serving our country. That's Joe Rivas, who on April the 12th, 1945, the very same day that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt died, was with the Timberwolves of the 104th Infantry Division when they discovered the horrors of a Nazi concentration camp in Nordhausen, Germany. He still has that large banner that he ripped down from a building there, taking away that symbol of, at that point, a fallen Nazi regime. You can see pictures of that banner and pictures of Joe at that age and his current age on our website, kmjnow.com. Also, some informational links about some of the sites and topics covered in today's program. Thank you so much for listening today. Again, no hometown heroes next week. Bulldog football at Wisconsin will bump us off for a week, but the program will return on September 19th with another local veteran of World War II. Thanks so much for listening. Again, I'm Paul Leffler. This has been Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.